Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 74. I'm recording it on Monday, January 12th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is, It's Not the Economy, Stupid. That's the slogan, of course. It's the economy, stupid, is a slogan that, forget the guy's name. Oh boy. Things that were so important once become unimportant with the passage of years, don't they? What was the guy's name? Carville. I forget his first name, but there was a guy, Jim Carville. Jim Carville was a advisor to President Clinton. I suppose it was Governor Clinton when he was running for the presidency. And Carville came up with a slogan for the campaign, which was, it's the economy, stupid. In other words, whenever Clinton was giving a talk, or anyone in the campaign was giving a talk, and they found themselves wandering into other issues, into distractions, Carville's job was to tell people, hey, people, we're going to win this election on our ideas for the economy. When was he running? I think was it 92? So the economy, I think, was a little shaky then. And the thought was that people are not feeling good about the economy. And so, you know, we're the group, we're the party out of power. We're going to put forward some new ideas. And the way we're going to win this election is by persuading people that we can do a better job with the economy than the people now in office. And if we find ourselves talking about, I don't even want to say what other issues, but of course all kinds of issues come up. The foreign engagements, if we find ourselves talking about social issues, if we find ourselves talking about, are Democrats better than Republicans, all this kind of thing. Some of these things might be temptations. We might have old scores we want to settle. And we want to say, yes, Democrats are better than Republicans. But that's a mistake to go down that path. What we want to do is to argue that we are going to improve the economy. That's how we're going to get reelected. It's the economy, stupid. That's what that motto for the Clinton campaign in 1992 meant. Well, that's a good motto for getting elected. At least it was in that election. And every campaign should have a theme like that. This is a side issue. I probably shouldn't do this, but I can't resist. Obama's campaign, of course, was change, which was a good slogan given where things stand. And a lot of people are in, change sounds good to a lot of people nowadays, but McCain just made me laugh. Not that there's, I'm not taking sides, but in his first debate he kept harping on earmarks. I'm gonna do away with those earmarks, And I don't think that was a particularly good campaign slogan. The end of earmarks. I don't think that was a winner. But anyway, the point here is you have to have an organizing theme to your campaign. You have to have an organizing theme. Well, The idea at the Retire Early Boards is to help people achieve financial freedom early in life. That's a sort of campaign. And just as happens in political campaigns, the biggest problem a lot of times is not that you can't do what you're trying to do, that you can't pull it off effectively. The problem often is just that you get distracted. You get pulled into all sorts of activities that are not the most important activities, not the things you should be devoting your limited time to and your limited energy to. So we need an organizing principle. We need a motto to direct our focus. And the motto I'm suggesting is, it's not the economy, stupid. Now, that's not really a motto, but the motto would be, if you were going to make it positive, it's higher returns at less risk, stupid. In other words, if when you are investing, the thought that is coming into your head frequently is, oh, I wonder how the economy is going to be doing 6 months out, then you're going about it all wrong, in Rob Bennett's opinion. It's not the economy, stupid. It's not the economy that matters. It seems sometimes like it is. You'll hear reports in the news and they'll say, oh, well, stocks are doing bad because of the economy. Well, that's a distraction. That's like the Clinton campaign, reading something in the newspaper about the Clinton campaign is doing well this week because of their new focus on foreign policy. See, that's a temptation. It might be true that you have a good week because of some debate that comes up on a foreign policy issue. But if you fall for that, if you then start redirecting your resources to win the foreign policy debate, you're probably not going to win the election, because you determined when you set your strategy that your winning issue was the economy. And if that's your winning issue, you play to that issue. You don't want, you might win the foreign policy question on merits, so to speak, but it might not be enough to get people to vote for you. They might say, yeah, they might go to the polling place and say, well, not the polling place, the voting place, and say, that Clinton guy, he's pretty good on that. I like what he says about Russia. I like what he says about Cuba too. He's got that down. I'm most worried about the economy. I'm going to vote for the other guy because I'm worried about the economy. Well, if that happens, you lost. Your job, you only have so many speeches, so many debates, so many talks, so many articles to persuade people. And if you decide that the job is to win on the economy, you better get out there and win on the economy. That's the point of that slogan. Well, that's the point. This is the point that investors need to understand. If you want to be a successful investor, focus on getting the highest returns at the lowest risk, and you'll be able to pull it off. It's doable. Focus on the economy, or even put 50% of your focus on the economy, and you're going to mess up because your energies are going to be diluted. You're not going to be stressing what really matters. Schiller has a quote in his book. I can't quote it exactly, but it's something along the lines of, a sign of intelligence is knowing what's important. And Schiller exemplifies that in his writings on investing. Schiller spends most of his efforts looking at the most important question, the question of valuations. That's what determines investing success. Valuations and the extent, to which you use valuations to change your allocation at the appropriate times. That's Schiller's message. Schiller focuses in on the thing that matters. Whereas a lot of these people, they're all over the lot. Now, you can have an argument. Are they all over the lot because they're not able to focus? Because they lack that intelligence that Schiller's talking about, or are they all over the lot because they're trying to please people? They're more salesmen than they are investing experts, and the general public is all over the lot. You see, the general public, you know, if you take a poll and you say to people, you know, what do you care about? You care about the economy, or do you care about, as an investor, what do you care about, the economy, or do you care about higher returns at lower risk? Most people are going to say, I care about higher returns at lower risk, of course. But that doesn't mean they do it. They may say the words. And, it, you know, a lot of campaigns will say, well, our focus is going to be the economy, or our focus is going to be change, you know, or our focus is going to be earmarks, whatever it happens to be. I mean, obviously, I'm playing fun there, but trying to think, what are some other slogans? Nixon had one. In 68, it was crime. Crime, was it crime in the streets? Was that the focus? I don't know the exact motto, but it was, his focus was crime. People were worried about crime in 68. So he knew, this is the issue, this is what I've got to drive home if I want to win this election. I'm trying to think what Reagan's was. Reagan obviously had a successful campaign in, and I can't really think what Reagan's campaign theme was, but now that must I imagine that must have also had an economic theme. Maybe it was tax cuts. Maybe that was the theme. I remember Reagan had big tax cuts, so maybe that was the theme. People were fed up. The taxes had gotten too high. And Reagan was campaigning on tax cuts. So the point is, you come up with a theme and you drill it. Well, what do you want to do as an investor? If you look at whatever's out there every day and let your attention wander to whatever is in the newspapers, I don't think you're gonna achieve your goals. I think you need a theme, and I think your theme should be, as an investor, I want the best possible returns with the lowest possible risk. And of course, it sounds so obvious, just as a lot of these campaign themes sound obvious. Doesn't it sound obvious you'd like to have less crime? Doesn't it sound obvious you'd like to have lower taxes, or you'd like to have change, or you'd like to have you know, a better economy, or fewer earmarks? You know? just in fairness, McCain's real theme was country first. That was his true theme. I didn't fully understand country first. I guess that's why I'm teasing a little bit. I think what he was getting, it took me a long time to understand what he was trying to say with country first. It doesn't, it has something to do with patriotism, but it didn't really register with me. And maybe it's a generational thing. I'll tell you what I think. This is off subject, but I'll get back. I'll make this short. But I think he was trying to appeal to the Perot voters. Country first strikes me as a Perot sort of campaign theme. And I think what McCain was thinking, or his strategists were thinking, is we need to get, you know, the job is to get 50% of the votes. And there's a certain number of Republican votes we're going to get. We're not worried about it. And there's a certain number of Democratic votes. And there ain't no way we're going to get them. And what we need to get are those people in the middle. And a lot of those people in that middle have sympathies for what Perot stood for, you know, when Perot ran as a third party candidate. And I think Country First was aimed at getting them. It was sort of they felt that McCain was a good candidate to get those people. And Perot, I think, probably would have been against earmarks, you know. So it was consistent with that, and Perot pushed a patriotic theme. So it was consistent with that. So I shouldn't make fun, but and there's nothing wrong with that strategy. It's a perfectly fine strategy. The part that made me laugh was when, in the debate, I think he said the word earmarks, you know, 7 times or 8 times, and it just made me laugh because I really don't think there's one person in the country who voted for him on the basis of his position on earmarks. That, you know, obviously there are many people voted for him for perfectly good reasons, but I don't think earmarks was really the defining issue in the 2008 campaign. Anyway, I'm talking about what your theme should be for achieving your investing goals, and a lot of people are talking, you know, what's happened is, of course, is, you know, passive investing, you know, Not my cup of tea. Passive investing is a disaster. Passive investing became extremely popular for a time, and it's failed. And now the people who advocate it are making excuses. They're saying, well, yeah, it failed. You know, we can't, you know, obviously the proof is in the pudding. What are we going to, but we don't want to give it up. We don't want to acknowledge making a mistake. Oh, no. Bad. That's bad. Can't do that. So what do we do? So what they're doing is they're saying, oh, it didn't fail because there's anything wrong with passive investing. Passive investing is fine. It's the economy. The economy's fault. Economy hurt us. That's why. That's why passive investing failed. That's why all our retirements are in jeopardy. That's why people are losing their jobs and retirements are going bust. It's that economy, that bad, bad economy did it to us. Well, obviously the economy, you know, is not exactly going gangbusters today. But an investing philosophy that does not work in all economic environments is an investing philosophy that does not work, period. What did they think was going to happen? They think the economy was, you know, always going to be, there was never going to be another recession? That's the way you get that impression. These people that come up with these ideas on investing, stay with the same stock allocation, ignore prices, timing doesn't work, buy and hold, stay the course, stocks for the long run. Did it never occur to them that there might be a recession at some point? And that this would be an unmitigated disaster in a recession? That in recessions, stock valuations return to normal levels or even subnormal levels, and that if we go to normal levels when we're starting at a PE10 level of 44, it's going to be the biggest wipeout of middle class wealth in history? Did this thought not occur to these people? What I'm saying is, if you think that you can predict the economy, then here's the thing. You've got to decide what can you predict and what can't you predict. If you think you can predict the economy, you don't need PE10 or valuation-informed indexing or rational investing. If you can predict the economy, you should engage in short-term timing. You should be in stocks when the economy is going to be going gangbusters in future days, and you should be out of stocks when the economy is going to be doing poorly, and you'll be rich. You know, easy peasy. There's a guy, Art. I got that easy peasy from Art, my old friend at Motley Fool. I steal from the best, my friends. Easy peasy. So, if you think you can predict the economy, do it. Stop listening to this podcast. Go predict some economies and go make some money, for heaven's sake. PassionSaving.com is not for people who think they can predict the economy. It's for people who think they can't predict the economy. There's some guy I saw a post on the internet once. He's not very well known, but I saw his name mentioned at a discussion board. John Bogle? Yeah, I think that was it. John Bogle. I think it was John Bogle. I saw his name mentioned at one of these, you know, discussion boards. And this John Bogle fellow, whatever it is, He said, I don't think we can predict the economy. I don't think short-term timing is such a hot idea. And, you know, made sense to me. So I stopped trying to predict the economy long, long time ago. As a citizen, I, of course, care about the economy. I don't want to come off sounding, you know, heartless. People are suffering. because of the failings of the economy today. I don't want to sound heartless, but it's not really my job to predict the economy. There are people who do that. They're called economists. But I'm not an economist. I'm a reporter. I try to report on what works in investing and in saving, and I try to help people incorporate those insights into their financial plans. So, I don't believe you can predict the economy. I think it's a big waste of time, big waste of energy. And I believe if you make your investing decisions according to what you think is going to happen with the economy, you're doing the wrong thing. You're going to get hurt. If you could do it consistently, you could do well. If you could do it consistently. But I don't believe you can. Now, this should be I understand there are some people who think you can, and I have no problem with it. That's fine. But what I don't understand is when people who claim to be bogleheads say that they can do it. And that's what people are saying today. These people who have followed passive investing, and passive investing is associated with John Bogle. You know, I think that's unfortunate, but it is, and it's not through anybody's fault but his own. Bogle has advocated rational investing. He has also advocated passive investing, and that's just the way it is. And it's quite understandable why people associate passive investing with John Bogle. It's because he has led them to believe that he endorses passive investing. And passive investing is not changing your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels. But what these people are saying now that they're ideas have failed is, I think the economy is going to get better, so it's okay. Or some of them are saying, I'm going to go to a zero stock allocation. This is what Bill Bangen says. And Taylor Larimore, I'm going to go to a zero stock allocation. But then when I think the economy is going to do better, well, I'll be getting back in. Well, that's predicting the economy and basing your stock decisions on it. That's bogleheadism. That's the opposite. Heaven help us all. That's the opposite of everything John Bogle stands for. And look, Bogle does it himself. Not in so obvious a way, but listen to his talks. And listen to the advice he gave early this year. He had some post up at the bogleheads.org board, and he said, I would be worried. I think the economy's not going to do so well. And I'm thinking, why is he talking about the economy? Why is he making economic predictions? I've seen Bogle in interviews where he'll be asked to comment on somebody else's economic predictions, and he will laugh, and quite rightly so, in my opinion. I think it's to laugh. These people, they get it right half the time, and they get it wrong half the time. You could do that flipping a coin. So Bogle laughs at them, but he does it himself. And this is documented. He does it himself. He offers economic predictions, and he suggests that people should change their stock allocations based on those predictions. He seems, he usually hesitates from saying the words, change your stock allocation, but he says, you'd better be careful, you'd better be nervous. Well, what are they supposed to do? Sit in a corner and have their teeth chatter until the economy does better? He's suggesting that people lower their allocations. And, of course, people do it. Many of the people at that board did just that. And he's doing it now. People are asking, why did your ideas fail? And he's saying, well, the economy. Well, I think all this talk about the economy is just, it's excuse making. A perfect example of this. This is an example. It always bugged me. There's a guy, Vanguard diehards, John D. Craig. I don't think that's his real name. That's a screen name. Great poster. One of the all-time great posters. John D. Craig stuck up for Rob Bennett / Hocus. I don't think there's ever been anybody who went to as much trouble to stick up for me as John D. Craig. I mean, John D. Craig stuck up for me more than I did, quite truthfully. He stuck up for me more than John Walter Russell did. I mean, John, is totally a stand-up guy. But you know, he'll fight a battle, and you know, when the battle's lost, he'll sort of, you know, drop out, quite understandably so. And I, to some extent, follow that practice. But John D. Craig, you know, he would fight a battle, and he'd get bloodied, and the next day he'd be right back there again. So John D. Craig doesn't have an ounce of bias against Rob Bennett in him, you know, based on the objective evidence. So I take what he says. You know, when he says something critical, I take it seriously because I know it's not being spoken out of bias. And there was a thread, and it just drove me crazy. But I had it. I have to believe he's sincere. And the thread was about terrorism. Somebody said, well, what if there were a terrorist attack? This is before the price crash. This is 2 years ago. Somebody said, well, you know, what if there's a price crash? I mean, what if there's a terrorist attack? You know, like the attack on the World Trade Center. What if there's another one? And the idea was this would cause a big price crash. So the concept was, what should you do to protect your portfolio in the event this would happen? And, you know, the dogmatic passive investors would say, well, you never know when the terrorist attack's going to come. You should just pick that stock allocation and stick to it. And, you know, stocks will come back after a terrorist attack. And, you know, dogma. And to their credit, at least they were logically consistent dogma. You know, I don't agree with the dogma, but they gave an answer that was consistent with their dogma. So that's, you know, that's what you would expect. John D. Craig argued that, you know, that wasn't prudent. He would say, well, if a terrorist attack would cause your prices to go down dramatically, you should lower your stock allocation because the odds of a terrorist attack are greater today than they were, you know, whenever before. They're greater. You know, based on, I don't know what he bases this on. I'm sure that there are quote-unquote experts out there who say the odds of a terrorist attack are greater. So, you know, I guess that's the reason. It's just like focusing on the economy, in my eyes. It's true that you can point to people who say there's going to be a terrorist attack, and there's also people who say there isn't. There's people who say maybe there is and maybe there isn't. I just feel you'll drive yourself crazy trying to predict all these things. In other words, the dynamic that always went on in all of our discussions is you had the dogmatic passive investors who had one position, and then you had, you know, Rob Bennett that had a totally contrary position, although I share many, many, many beliefs I share with the dogmatics, but I don't agree with them at all on sticking to the same stock allocation. And then you had these people in the middle, like John D. Craig, who agreed with me that you should change your stock allocation, but they had a hard time saying that you should change it based on the PE10 level. They'd say, you should change it because the economy's going to do bad. That's what Bogle does, or Taylor Larimore, or Bill Bangin. Or John D. Craig would say, you should change it because there's going to be a terrorist attack. And on that issue, I'm totally with the dogmatics, because the dogmatics are right. You cannot predict this stuff. And if I lowered my stock allocation, you know, when the first time people started worrying about these terrorist attacks was after 9/11. Well, what are you going to do? We didn't have a terrorist attack from 9/11, September 2001. It's now January 2009. We haven't had a terrorist attack of any significance in the United States in that time. You know, it's over seven years. So what are you going to do? You're going to lower your stock allocation. If it doesn't come 3 years, you're going to increase it again? This is what I mean. You're allowing your eye to get off the ball, focusing on terrorist attacks or first focusing on the economy. It's the same thing. Anything other than stock valuations is a mistake, in my opinion. If you're trying to get, you know, as a citizen, of course you should be worried about terrorist attacks. As a citizen, of course you should be worried about economic developments. As a stock investor, you should be worried about getting the best possible return with the lowest possible risk. And the way you do that is by looking at valuations. So I said on this thread, you know, I put forward a post, and I said, you know, everybody gave their take. John D. Craig, I think he might have started, maybe he didn't start the thread, but he certainly commented on it, and others did. And so I gave the Rob Bennett take. I see this as my job. And I said, my take is, I wouldn't worry about terrorist attacks. I would worry about valuation levels. I said, right now, valuations are sky high. At the time of this thread, they were. And so if there's a terrorist attack, you're going to lose massive amounts of money. It's going to be a killer. You know, I don't know. Let's just say the valuation level was 30. I don't know what it was. If a terrorist attack sends it down to 10, you're going to lose two-thirds of your money. 10's not that much below fair value. It's below fair value, but a terrorist attack might well send us below fair value. You're going to lose two-thirds of your money. I said, you know, if valuations were reasonable today, if valuations were 14, which is fair value, I wouldn't be all that worried about a terrorist attack. Maybe a little bit, but not that much, because a drop from 14 to 10 isn't going to wipe you out. It's going to hurt, but it's not going to wipe you out. So I said, what I care about is the valuation level. That's what determines my stock allocation, not what I read in the papers about terrorist attacks and economic developments. And John D. Craig, he got angry. As I said, he's not biased against Rob Bennett. He stuck up for me, I don't know how many times. I mean, I was embarrassed how many times the guy stuck up for me. He's a hero. I mean, he took a lot of hits. I took a lot of hits. But he didn't take as many hits as I did, but he took a lot of hits. And he was taking hits, you know, he wouldn't have taken them if he weren't sticking up for me. And sticking up for me was like, you know, asking for it. But he got angry. He didn't like it. He said, you know, and he came back with this thing. He says, "Oh, Rob, you have to change every discussion into consideration of your favorite idea, PE10. It's always about valuations with you, isn't it?" The answer to that question is yes. Yes, it always is. It always is. Why? Because the subject matter of the board is stock investing. It's not terrorism. If it were a terrorism board, I would talk about terrorism. If it were a economic prediction board, I would talk about economic predictions. I'm not interested. I'm interested in stock investing. And for the stock investor, what matters is the valuation level. Terrorist attacks ain't going to hurt you none if the valuation level is low. But if the valuation level is insanely high, like it was at the time of that thread, yeah. The point here is, When the PE10 level is 30, as it was at the time of that thread, roughly, I don't know exactly, anything can cause a massive loss. A terrorist attack, an increase in gas prices can cause a massive price crash. Assassination of a president could cause a massive price crash. A natural disaster, you know, a hurricane that wiped out a city could cause a massive price crash. A recession could cause a massive price crash. A scandal in the financial industry, like this Bernie Madoff thing, could cause a price crash. Anything could do it. The point is, when you're surrounded by things that can cause you to lose two-thirds of your retirement money, maybe you want to lower your allocation down to a reasonable level for that sort of environment. Is that so complicated? Is that so hard to understand? It's not at all hard to understand. It's simple. It's so simple. I think the biggest problem that people have with a lot of the stuff I put forward is it's too simple. They say, "Rob, I can't understand that. It's too simple." You know, all these other experts talk all this gibberish, and you come on the scene with simple declarative sentences, and that can't be right. It's got to be more complicated than that. It can't be that PE10 is the whole problem. That would be it. That would be the whole problem right there. Here's a, I'll give you a little This is back of the envelope numbers, okay? If some smart person, some smart numbers oriented person wants to challenge these numbers, please do. I would like to have better numbers, but I'm just a little hobbit trying to find my way to the, what is it called? Mount Doom, and drop that ring in where it can be burned, where it can be melted down and to dethrone Sauron. So hobbits don't know numbers. Hobbits don't know numbers. But I'm going to give you some numbers that I've picked up just in my reading. And I haven't checked, so I don't know if they're precisely accurate, but it sounds to me like they're roughly accurate. I've read in numerous places that the current, the price crash we've lived through in the past 15, 16 months is roughly $8 trillion of losses in stocks. Okay? $8 trillion. And that's basing it on a 40% price drop. Depends on when you measure it. There's different days you can measure it. A 40% price crash is $8 trillion. Robert Shiller had a column where he said the total price drop going back to January of 2000 is not 40%, it's 60%. So 60% is 50% more than 40%. So let's take 50% of the 40% loss, and that's instead of $8 trillion, that's $4 trillion. Let's add the $4 trillion to the $8 trillion, and we have the total loss going back to January of 2000. 4 plus 8 is 12. So total $12 trillion loss. Now, there's another $4 trillion that's been lost from the housing bubble, the drop in housing prices. That's another $4 trillion. So let's add that to it, and now we've got not $12 trillion, we've got $16 trillion in losses. And now we've got one more possible stock crash ahead of us. The three earlier times we've gone to the passive/emotional approach to investing, we haven't fallen to fair value, which is where we are today. We've fallen 50% lower than that, half of fair value. So that would be another $4 trillion, roughly. So 16 plus 4 is $20 trillion. So, it could be when all is said and done that the passive investing stock crash starting from January 2000, proceeding through whatever day in the future, could be 5 years from now, we get down to a P10 level of 7 or 8, will end up having cost us $20 trillion. Now, it's very important to understand, when I say cost us $20 trillion, that doesn't mean that when people hear that, what they think is that there's $20 trillion that somehow disappeared. And of course, people always ask this question, well, where did the money go? And I have a whole podcast on that question, one of the early ones. There's not $20 trillion that disappeared. What happened is we pretended that $20 trillion had been created in the insane bull market of the 1990s. We pretended there were not economic gains that justified the increase in prices we saw in the 1990s. What we did was we just bid prices up to these insane levels, and we all pretended that it was real. And then, of course, we made financial decisions, presuming that money was real. So people went out. We had $20 trillion. And of course, the $20 trillion was distributed across the board. I mean, consumers went out and bought, if they had two cars, they bought three. If they had one, they bought two. If they had three, they bought four. People that were in houses that were X number of square feet, if they had X number of square feet, they moved up to a house with two times X square feet. If they had a practice of going on a vacation to the beach every summer for a week, they changed it to 2 weeks, or they changed it to, going to Hawaii, rather than going to the beach, including air travel, whatever. They started spending more. In hundreds of different ways. If they used to go to the movies once a week, they started going twice a week. On and on and on. Because there was $20 trillion floating around they thought they had. Same thing, you know, with the government. You know, they say that, you know, there's this big debate. Who was responsible for Freddie Mac? You know, all these disastrous home loans. Oh, the Democrats say it was the Republicans' fault. There wasn't enough regulations. The Republicans say it was the Democrats' fault. They were giving money out to people that didn't, you know, wasn't responsible. They didn't have enough income to support these mortgages. Well, as far as I'm concerned, both things are true. But also, both things are understandable. You know, what would you think people would do if there's $20 trillion extra floating around? In other words, when Congress makes a decision to provide housing to people of low incomes, what sort of considerations go through their heads? Let's presume they're good people. You know, I understand, you know, politicians are not saints. I get that. But instead of being cynical and saying, oh, you know, they're stealing and they're doing this and they're doing that, can we just presume for a minute that maybe they're not 100% corrupt? Maybe they have, you know, a little bit of conscience. Maybe the reason they got into politics in the first place is that they'd like to do some good. So they have one of the things that a lot of people would like is to have a house, and they can't afford a house. And the politician says, well, can we afford to pass a program that would give these people housing? Now, they look at the books and they say, well, there's $20 trillion here we're not doing anything with. Yeah, I guess we could be a little more generous. You see, that's what I believe has been going on ever since passive investing became popular and caused the most insane, out-of-control bull market in history. The politicians need to be able to look at the numbers in order to decide, you know, how generous should they be with, you know, with the country's resources. And they can't make a good decision unless the numbers are right. And if we're all pretending that this $20 trillion in phony money is real, they can't make good decisions. So we made a lot of bad decisions. Consumers made a lot of bad decisions. The government made a lot of bad decisions. Businesses made a lot of bad decisions. Businesses, you know, they're all hitting on the auto industry now. The auto industry. Bailout. You know, our auto companies, they can't figure out how to run a company, can they? They can't sell their cars, right? Well, maybe with $20 trillion extra floating around, it's a little hard to figure out how to build a car and how to sell it. Why? We live in something called a capitalist economy. People need to stop a minute and think what that means. What is a capitalist economy? Why does it work? The reason why a capitalist economy works is because it's a feedback mechanism. You create a certain car, you offer it for sale, and people either buy or they don't buy. And you're learning what people want by whether they buy or not. Well, guess what? If you put out a car that costs, let's just say, $30,000, and people buy it, you're gonna conclude they want that car, and you're gonna make more of them. But what if all the money is phony money? What if it's $20 trillion of monopoly money out there? And now, one day, the monopoly money disappears, as it must, of course. Monopoly money doesn't last. It's not real. Now there's nobody to buy the $30,000 car. So, you know, you ramped up production, you made millions of these things, and nobody wants them. Hello, bankruptcy. Hello, bailout. What I'm trying to say is the auto companies are not bad. And the auto companies are not stupid. And the government's not bad, and the government's not stupid. There's obviously bad, stupid people in the government and in the auto companies. And there's bad, stupid people among consumers. But consumers, as a rule, are not bad or stupid either. Let's stop calling everybody names. And let's try to solve the problem. The problem is not the economy. It's not our economic system. It's not a lack of regulation. It's not too much regulation. It's not Democrats. It's not Republicans. That's another one that gets to me. The Democrats, of course, you know, I mean, obviously, in a political campaign, you're going to try to pin something like this on the other party. So they say, oh, it's Bush's fault. Well, you can argue it's the Democrats' fault. It's Clinton's fault. The out-of-control bull market happened during Clinton's administration. It was 95 through 2000 was the worst of it. Clinton was in office. So, you could certainly make a good case. It's Clinton's fault. Blame Clinton. Or you could blame Greenspan. Greenspan was the Fed chairman during Clinton's administration. I don't know whether Clinton had any idea, but Greenspan certainly should have. Greenspan's admitted he made mistakes. I give him credit for that. But you can't say it's the Democrats' fault because Bush came in 2000 and he didn't exactly jump on it. So he didn't do any better. It's not the Democrats, it's not the Republicans. It's not the consumers, it's not the businesses. It's all of us. It's the human weakness, the get-rich-quick impulse within every human, every Democrat, every Republican, every consumer, every business owner, every banker, every automaker. We all want money for nothing. It's called sin. Call it goonishness. If you don't believe in sin, call it goonishness. Call it what you want. We all want to believe in something for nothing. And we all need help not to fall for that trick. It's a trick. It never works. Something for nothing never, ever, 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 ever works. What we need from investing experts is tools to help us not fall for the nonsense, the dangerous nonsense. And passive investing says, hey, maybe timing doesn't work. Maybe you don't have to change your stock allocation when prices go to insane levels. Maybe that will work this time. It's never worked before, but hey, with a lot of pixie dust, I bet we could do it. Why don't we try it? Let's all try not changing our stock allocation. Let's see how high we can pump prices up this time. Hey, we're all rich. It's bull market. We're rich. We're doing good. Yeah, we're doing real good. Doing real, real good. I don't believe in the baloney. Passive investing equals baloney. There ain't no world, there ain't no alternate universe in which it's a good idea not to change your stock allocation when prices go to insane levels. So says Rob Bennett. All right, I need to pull it back to the theme here. The theme here is people are getting distracted. I talked in the last podcast about cognitive dissonance. People have come to believe in this passive investing nonsense. No one can say why. I spent 7 years trying to get an answer to that question. I know that a lot of people believe it. That comes through loud and clear. I say to them, why do you believe it? And they say, well, everybody else believes in it. I say, well, okay, that's true. Why does everybody else believe in it? The experts believe in it. Okay, that's true. The experts believe in it. Why do the experts believe in it? The experts believe in it because everybody believes in it. Everyone believes in it. So the experts believe in it. Okay. Everyone believes in it. Why does everyone believe in it again? I answered that one already. The experts believe in it. That's why. I answered that one. Aren't you listening? Don't you listen to my answers? We all believe in it because the experts believe in it, and the experts believe in it because we all believe in it. Good strategy. I don't believe in it because, first of all, it makes precisely zero sense. That's one reason I don't believe in it. That's the biggest reason. Second reason I don't believe in it is because I've looked at the historical data, and we have data going back to 1870, and it has never worked. But, you know, cognitive dissonance is reality. People have now, you know, they're feeling discomfort. They're saying, I believe in this idea, it hasn't worked, and I'm feeling discomfort, and now what do I do? And what people are saying is, oh, I know, I'll blame it on the economy. You know, what can I blame it on? Well, the economy, blame anything on the economy, and people will believe it. You know, I mean, everybody, the economy is cause of everything, every problem there is today. Let's blame the economy. And what I'm saying is, if your investing philosophy can't survive a bad economy, your investing philosophy stinks. Stinks up the joint. You know, get a new investing philosophy, please. If that's the story you're going to tell. Because that doesn't fly. You've got to decide. Everybody has to predict something. The knock you get on valuation-informed indexing is, oh, you can't predict the future, Rob. Oh, Rob, you are so wrong. What are you, the great Carmack? What, you have a crystal ball? You can't predict the future, Rob. If you can't predict the future, you can't invest. If everything is just a random number generator, everything's a gamble. If you cannot predict the future at all, you can't dare to put your money in stocks. You might as well put it in lottery tickets. But of course, nobody believes you can't predict the future. Everyone who invests in stocks, who put, you know, more than a few dollars, everyone who puts their retirement money in stocks believes that you can predict the future. None of them believe you can predict it 100%, but all believe you can predict it to a reasonable degree. And that's, of course, the truth. That's reality. The only thing that rational investing adds is it says, part of what's involved in if you're going to predict the future to a reasonable degree, you've got to think about the mechanics of that. How is it that we predict the future to a reasonable degree? And the answer is, we look at the profits generated by the underlying businesses. And that tells us what our stock return is going to be. And in the United States, if you're buying a broad U.S. index, you can go back many, many, many years, and the return on a U.S. stock investment, the average return, is 6.5% real. All of that's non-controversial. The passive investing dogmatists agree with me that far. The only difference is they fail to do the last step. The average return is 6.5% real. But we don't invest on average, do we? We invest at particular times, don't we? So what I say is, if you want to invest rationally, you don't ignore that reality. You add that one more layer. And you say, what is the likely return at today's prices? Not the average. I don't want to know average. I can't invest average. I want to know today. Today's prices. I've got to buy stocks today or else not buy them. I can't buy them in the future, and I can't buy them in the past. What's the likely return today, the likely long-term return? Just as all passive investors predict, you know, long-term returns, or else they couldn't put their money in stocks, it would be gambling. I do the same thing. All rational investors do the same thing. It's obviously not just me who does this. But what the rational investors do different is they don't pretend that the average is the number that applies at all times. What they do is they calculate the likely long-term return at the particular time in question when the stock investment is being considered. And that number, of course, varies greatly. Buy stocks at a P10 level of 8, and your likely 10-year annualized real return is 17%. 17% per year plus inflation every year for 10 years. Buy at the price level that applied in January of 2000, and your likely annualized 10-year return is a negative number. You will likely lose money every year for 10 years. Obviously, you won't lose every single year, but on average, your wealth will decline 10 years running if you invest in stocks. Now, those are, that's just a fact. Those are numbers. That's not opinion. If you look at the historical data and you perform, you apply statistical tools to it, you will come to the same answer as in the stock return predictor calculator at my website. So what I'm saying is you've got to try to predict something. If you want, if you think you can predict the economy, well, God bless you. Go do it. But I don't think you can do it. I'm persuaded by what John Bogle teaches that you can't do it. That's short-term timing. So when you give up on short-term timing, you've got to turn to long-term timing. What the passive investors do is they say, give up on all timing. Just throw your money in regardless. And I say, that's insane. That means you're either going to be, what's your stock allocation going to be? Is it good? There's one price level at which the likely 10-year return is 17% per year. And there's one where the likely 10-year return is a negative 1% per year. Well, what allocation makes sense for that? If you go with 20% allocation, well, you're massively underinvested for the time when the return is 17% per year. You're leaving tons of money on the table. If you go with an 80% allocation, you're massively overinvested for the time when the 10-year return is a negative number. The only way to make sense out of stock investing is to change your allocation based on the price level. It's the only thing that makes any sense at all, in Rob Bennett's opinion. And that's rational investing, that's valuation-informed indexing, and that's all it is. That's all it is. It's sanity. All that Rob Bennett says is, can we discuss investing sanely? Instead of pretending that there might be some merit to passive investing, which is transparently insane. I do not mean to insult my listeners. If you're a passive investor, please. That's not my intent, but I do mean to criticize this investing approach, which has caused such human misery. What kills me is, what people are saying today is they're saying, and Bogle does this, well, not just Bogle, they all do it. They say, Obama's, coming in. Today is January 12th. So he's coming in a week or two. So he's going to put it, say he puts his program in, his economic program. Say it passes. And say stocks shoot up. Say they go up. That certainly could happen. Certainly a plausible scenario. People will say, the market is anticipating, the economic recovery. Well, that's great. That's really helpful information. So they never spell out exactly what it means to anticipate anything, but let's just say it means that 6 months out, the economic program is going to have improved everything and the businesses will be back on their feet and consumers will be spending again, all this sort of thing. And so what the stock market is telling you is 6 months out, everything's back. Well, that's all well and good. Just because they anticipate that 6 months out things are going to be good doesn't mean that 7 months out things aren't going to be horrible again. Maybe the market will go up in February because it's anticipating that whatever 6 months is from February, July, or August, whatever it is going to be good, and then September is going to be awful. So you'll put all your money back. Bill Bangen will be back in the market. Taylor Larimore will be back in the market. They'll put all their money back in February, when everything's shooting to the moon, and then March comes along and everything crashes again. They lose the second time. That's smart investing. The whole idea of the market, the quote-unquote market, anticipating the future is nonsense. It really is. Just think for a minute. What is it people are saying when they say the market is going to anticipate something? The market is us! The market is stock investors. It's the same people. When they say the market is anticipating, they're saying we are anticipating it. It's all circular. You know, it's all true. I mean, if we decide that we think things are going to go good, it certainly is true. We have the power to send prices up. So if tomorrow morning, you know, it's a really sunny day out and we all feel, you know, in the old days, there'd be songs on the radio. Now they don't seem to have that anymore. But say that the Beatles came out with a really happy, bright song and we all woke up tomorrow and said, yeah, I'm happy and I'm going to buy stocks because I'm happy. It's true that prices would go up. It's true that in that sense, we could anticipate good times and reflect that in stock prices, but there's no reality to it. Just because we're anticipating it doesn't mean it's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen. And the market is just us. When they say the market anticipates something, they're saying we anticipate something. Well, thanks for telling us what we anticipate. What value is there in knowing that? If we already anticipate it, we don't need to be told we anticipate it. What matters is the realities, not the anticipations. What you can predict long-term stock returns. You cannot predict the economy because there are 1,000 factors that affect what's going to happen with the economy. I don't think anyone can predict it. Obviously, people try, and every now and then somebody gets it right, but that's just luck. But stock returns, that you can predict. And the reason you can predict it is PE10 is not based on any short-term prediction. The bottom part of the equation is the average of earnings of 10 years. So what PE10 is saying, this is comparing today's price to how stocks perform over what sort of earnings we get in a 10-year period, not in 1 year or 6 months. So it's real. In 10 years, there are going to be good times. There are going to be bad times. So compare the price to what happens over 10 years, and you're looking at something real. And if the price is double what it should be, based on how stocks perform over 10-year periods, well, then you know that stock prices are headed down. You can predict that. When the price is double what it should be, the odds that it's headed down are very, very high. And when it's half of what it should be, the odds that it's going up are very, very high. So, what I'm trying to say, I want to sum it up, is that every investor predicts something. You can't give up your money without making some sort of prediction. It's impossible. If you make no prediction at all, if you just think it's all random, you're gambling. You're not investing. So, you know, what I'm saying is a tautology. If I say every investor predicts, because the ones who make no predictions at all are not investors, they're gamblers. Every investor predicts. The question is, what is it you are predicting? Are you predicting the economy, or terrorism, or gas prices, or the elections, or, something like that, something that cannot be predicted? Or are you predicting long-term stock prices, which have always been predictable, and which always will be predictable? I say, forget the predictions that can't be done. Take your focus off of all that junk, and focus it on what can be predicted, which is long-term stock returns. Not the economy, not short-term stock returns. Long-term stock returns can be effectively predicted. That's what should determine your stock allocation. You learn about that by looking at PE10 and whether we are at low prices, fair prices or high prices. Today we're at fair prices. 16 months ago, we were at insanely high prices. And of course, investing heavily in stocks turned out to be a very, very bad idea. Today, we may see another price drop. We might not. The odds today, though, if you're a long-term investor, if you're investing for 10 years out, the odds favor you. That's the difference. That's the difference. Investing today in stocks versus investing in stocks 16 months ago. Not that I can tell you exactly what's going to happen on a month-by-month basis. What I can tell you is that if you're a long-term investing, the odds now favor you. That's rational investing. Looking at the odds, getting the odds in your favor. And in order to do that, you don't have to be a super genius. It's very simple. But there is something you have to do. You have to tune out all this junk. And Bogle says that. But where Bogle makes his mistake is, he tunes out some of the junk when he says ignore these predictions about what the economy is going to do. But then he adds junk of his own when he tells people to invest passively. You got to tune out the passive investing junk too, because that's just more emotionalism. What you need to do is focus not on the economy, but on how stock returns are likely to go. You need to focus on getting the best possible return at the lowest possible risk. And that means changing your allocation so that your risk level is roughly constant. So that when the risk of stocks is low, you go with a relatively high stock allocation. And when the risk level is high, you go with a relatively low stock allocation. It's stocks that matter for the stock investor, not the economy. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.